going to be reading two pieces from Genesis. First one is from Genesis 1, and I'll be reading that. And would you be willing to read the Genesis 3 piece that's on there? Thanks. Genesis 1, 2, and 3 are obviously cheek to jowl with one another. But they're actually separated by many hundreds of years of time. Genesis 2 and 3, the Adam and Eve story, is actually a much older story than Genesis 1, which most scholars think dates to the Babylonian exile. But Genesis 1 so shapes how we read all of Scripture. What it is to be human. And what God is like. This is our second to last week of our wrestling with the question of what is God like? And we've been using the two terms I've overused for the last month and change. Cruciform, which means cross-shaped, the cross-shaped cruciform love of Christ. And the other word is kenosis, which means pouring out, the kenotic love of God in creation. I've chosen some unusual translations for our readings today. One, because they're closer to the original Hebrew. And two, when we've heard this story a million times, we think we know what's there. And so hearing a different translation makes us go, oh, check that out. So here from Genesis 1, a key part of the reading. Then Elohim said, let us make humankind in our image according to our likeness, and let them be caretakers of the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and of the cattle and of all the wild animals of the earth and of every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So Elohim created humankind in God's image. In the image of God were they created, male and female. God created them. And now an ancient story of how we kind of messed it up.
Now the snake was more shrewd than all the living things of the field that Yahweh God had made. It said to the woman, even though God said, you are not to eat from any of the trees in the garden. The woman said to the snake, from the fruit of the other trees in the garden we may eat, but from the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you are not to eat from it, and you are not to touch it, lest you die. The snake said to the woman, die? You will not die. Rather, God knows that on that day that you eat from it, your eyes will be opened and you will become like gods, knowing good and evil. The woman saw that the tree was good for eating and that it was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to contemplate. She took from its fruit and ate and gave also to her husband beside her, and he ate. The eyes of the two of them were opened, and they knew then that they were nude. They sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. Now they heard the sound of Yahweh God walking about in the garden at the breezy time of the day. And the human and his wife hid themselves from the face of Yahweh God amid the trees of the garden. Yahweh God called to the human and said, where are you? He said, I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid because I am naked and so I hid myself. God said, who told you that you are naked? From the tree about which I commanded you not to eat, have you eaten? The human said, The woman whom you gave to be beside me, she gave me from the tree, and so I ate. Yahweh God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? The woman said, the snake enticed me, and so I ate. The man named his wife Chava, because she was the mother of all living. And Yahweh God sewed garments of skins for the man and for the woman, and clothed them.
Thank you, Joshua. So these past 7 weeks, we've been looking at the nature of God as seen through the cruciform, that is, cross-shaped lens of Jesus. In the incarnation, in God's letting go of divinity and power to become human, we see most clearly that this poured out self-emptying nature of God. The fancy Greek word again for that is kenosis. So you might be saying, sure, I can see in the New Testament where God's son seems to be a nice brown-skinned Jewish liberal offering food and free health care for poor people. But what about that wrathful, angry, petulant, vengeful, violent God we read about in the Old Testament? Well, a couple of things. That cartoon Old Testament God doesn't exist. Christians have created the Old Testament God. And yes, there are many awful and toxic portraits of God in the Hebrew Scriptures, which I feel are human projection far more than they are about the reality of the nature of God. The lightning-throwing, angry bachelor storm God we sometimes see hinted at in Scripture is, frankly, pagan. It's more Marduk than it is Yahweh. It's more Zeus than it is the Father of Jesus Christ. And second, is that there are at least as many tender and loving and intimate portraits of God as there are angry and wrathful. And we Christians, I got to say this, and it's a part of our toxic history against Judaism, we tend to interpret these stories in the most wrathful way possible when we interpret ancient Jewish scripture. Jewish tradition usually has a much healthier way of interpreting some of these problematic texts than we Christians do. And third, I want to say that when we interpret these texts as Christians, it can help us when looking at the God of the Hebrew Scriptures as also being the Abba, Papa, Father of Jesus, the Son. Reading through the cross-shaped lens of God's nature, and we can find in there a God of grace, even in the difficult texts. We can, as I said in the title, unwrath Torah. So I want us to wrestle with, like they're doing downstairs apparently, wrestle with one of the tough texts from the beginning. And it starts in the beginning. You've read it a million times. But that key set of verses in the middle of chapter 1 where the text says, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them be caretakers of the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? You all had a few in class this morning.
To be vengeful.
Oh, to be vengeful, to be made in the image of God?
If
you think of God as vengeful, then yeah, maybe that would be it.
If you think of him as love, then you're loving him.
So the image we have of God shapes very much how it is we think about what it is to be made in the image of God. I think the text gives us a hint when it says, let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them be caretakers of the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air. Being in the image of God, in part, is about being caretakers. Now, many English translations use words like dominion, which we have gone to town on over the last 2,000 years. But the text indicates a caretaking of creation, not a stomping it out. When people of faith see virgin forest, they're supposed to see this incredibly complex poem of interrelated living beings. Not, oh, there might be some carbon hiding underneath there for me to take. We're called to be caretakers. And in Genesis chapter 2, when we get to a Garden of Eden, what are the humans doing in there? They're caretaking, literally, taking care of a garden. Caretaking the garden. So let's look at this image of God thing a little deeper. Fancy Latin phrase, imago Dei, which means image of God. Somehow we are all imprinted with this divine thumbprint. And I think imago Dei means that we are called to live as God's representatives. We have a calling as children of God, a job as caretakers, to be about co-creating and protecting and loving. But the world is obviously also messed up, and the imago Dei in us has been twisted and perverted and made incomplete by sin and greed and corruption. But we are still called to partner with the God we meet in Jesus to be about the redeeming of our fallen, messed up world. In Judaism, that term is tikkun. We've talked about that word before, tikkun, to be about bringing wholeness, repair to the world. So that's in Genesis 2. We have this garden. Everything's going pretty hunky-dory until we get to chapter 3 and something bad happens that Augustine calls a fall. The rabbis don't. The rabbis say it was not a good thing, but a fall from grace, no. But something bad happens that Augustine calls a fall from grace. What was the thing that caused this fall from grace? What happened?
Apple eating.
Eve, according to our popular culture, Eve ate an apple, ergo, everything sucks. Hello? That's, really? Is that an overreaction? Okay, probably not eating an apple. It just says fruit, by the way. Fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I've always been taught when I was young that it was a symbol of grasping for power, a listening to the lies of the serpent that power equals the image of God. So what the humans did in eating the apple, listening to the serpent saying, die, you will not die. The day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. Power is what being like God is like. So Adam and Eve strove for power in order to be like God. I was always told it was an act of hubris, of disobedience, in order to strive to be like God, which God did not like, and therefore we were punished. But if we take Genesis 1 seriously, Adam and Eve, caretaking in the garden, are already living in the image of God. Here's something about what happens to the image of God when God creates humanity, especially if we think about God as being equivalent of power. In making room for creation itself, God needs to draw back in order to make room for creation. And in creating human beings with free will, with beings able to say yes or no to God, that means God's power has to be drawn back fully around human decision making. Do you hear that? God, the one who brought everything into being itself, the God who is being itself, when it comes to human freedom, has to draw back in order to make room for that freedom. If God's power is over human decision making, there is no free will. If there is true free will, then God does not have ultimate power over the decision making. For us to be able to say no to God, there has to be free will. For there to be free will, God's power has to be voluntarily laid down when it comes to human decision making. It's a radical, radical idea. This is where that Greek term kenosis, pouring out, self-emptying. God self-empties God's power out of respect for human dignity, the ability of human beings to say yes or no to God's will. In creation itself, we see a blueprint for what the image of God is like, and it is deliberately laying down our own power in order for something else to be able to grow. Whether it's the caretaking in the garden, for God creating space for creation itself to come into existence and grow, and for God's respect of human free will to step back and allow that to happen. Theologians talk about God being the first cause, God being itself. God's let there be light is first cause. And God allows second causes. Second causes might be gravity. Gravity's good. It keeps us, from flying off the planet. But don't step off a tall building. God will give you the free will to step off a tall building. God will give you the free will to build a city on a fault line. God respects that. It may be not wise, but God allows second causes, whether it's natural law or human freedom, for good or ill. And 98% of our problems have to do with human beings' free will, grasping for power, grasping for authority, grasping for stuff. Most of our problems come out of that grasping for power. So here's the irony. God illustrates God's power through laying it down. God illustrates God's power by granting freedom and power with and for others. God's way of looking at power is giving it away, laying it down. And the fall was not Eve grabbing power in reality, because she already had it. Adam already had it as being caretakers in the garden. What they did in reality was enslave themselves to a million idols of their own making, their own ideas about what constitute power. That's what humanity has been doing for our entire messed up history. I want to be godlike. That means I'm going to be emperor. That means I'm going to take over the universe. I want to be a 6 trillionaire rather than just a 4 trillionaire like that guy. I want my will to be done, my power, my authority. And yet the image of God in reality has been one who lays down power to allow for growth and freedom for others. God let go of the power to direct and cajole and force humanity towards God's will in order to respect human freedom. And since then, human beings have done everything they can to grab onto whatever power can direct and cajole and force other human beings to do their will. Eating at the fruit was grasping at power, was grasping that which is not the image of God, the Imago Dei. It was a false God that is responsible for much of human misery, grasping at power, forcing my will on others, coercion rather than consent. And you can name a million examples, and I've seen you write letters, and I've seen you on picket lines, and I've seen you in protest against some of those very things. If it's got an ism on the end of it, it's probably one of those graspings at power. There's a word I haven't used yet, and it's an important one. That kenotic, cross-shaped love is a vulnerable love. For God to no longer micromanage every human decision, like a robot or a computer would do, free will means God is vulnerable to human decision-making. God becomes naked in a metaphorical sense, vulnerable to human saying no to love, no to God's will. So the irony is complete when after Adam and Eve partake of the fruit, what they think is going after the power of God, the first thing they notice after they eat of the fruit, we're naked. We're vulnerable. What I think broke God's heart in this story is not that an apple got eaten. It's not that a rule got broken. Maybe you got that in Sunday school. God said don't eat the apple, and they ate the apple, so we're all cursed for all eternity. What broke God's heart was watching as the deep truth of love got replaced by the lie of power, which led to shame, which led to being emotionally crippled. The blessed assurance that these two precious humans were beloved of God was replaced by the fear that they were insufficient and now would constantly be grasping for power. When one recognizes one is naked, one is always looking for security. What is the next thing that will protect me? Maybe I need a bigger army. Maybe I need a bigger house. Maybe I need to get bodyguards. Maybe I need to get guns. Maybe I need thermonuclear weapons. Maybe I need something so I feel more secure, so I'm not naked. That's why God asks in anguish, where are you in the garden? Where are you? Who told you that you were naked? Who told you that you were insufficient? Who told you that being loved was not enough? Who told you these lies? Can you hear the pain in God's voice? It is not a voice of a vengeful God, angry at human disobedience. That's the voice of a loving parent who was heartbroken at seeing shame creep into the very DNA of these beloved humans. Remember, in chapter 2, we didn't read it today, but in chapter 2, this is the God who knelt on hands and knees to tenderly shape the human creature, Ha-Adamah, the red earth creature, who breathed spirit into its lungs to bring it to life. This is the God who yearns for nothing more and nothing less than a relationship of mutual love and trust with us mixed up bags of muscles and guts and souls and brain and bone. This is the God who, despite everything, is crazy in love with us. And we turned away from love for a lie. Now, there were some serious consequences from this brokenness and sin and shame. The expulsion from the garden and all that comes from it are symbolic of lost innocence, the loss of mutual vulnerability, the loss of trust between man and woman, human and God, human and creation. But I love the last little detail of this story, and this is crucial. Even in the midst of the painful consequences of Eden, God doesn't give up. Now, in my head, growing up in a neo-Calvinist tradition, it's, oh, humans, I made you, I love you, you sinned, away. I cannot stand to look on human sin, you're off. Blah. That's not what happens in this text. God still works to maintain a loving relationship. And the last scene, here is God, creator of the universe, hunched over a bunch of animal skins like a grandma at a sewing machine, painstakingly threading together the clothes that these humans are going to need to survive in a suddenly cold, cruel world. There would be work and pain ahead of them to wrestle food from the soil and give birth to kids and raise families, but the God who loved them would be with these humans every difficult step of the way. God does not give up on us. And Hebrew Scriptures gives us lots of human history and all its glory and blood and awfulness and beauty. But here's the good news. There was another garden. There was another Adam. There was another tree. Where someone who knew that true power was giving up power. Paul calls Jesus the new Adam. Who had a temptation in the wilderness. Once again, a temptation. Do you remember what Satan says? If you are the Son of God, grab political power. If you are the Son of God, do the magic tricks that makes everyone follow you. If you are the Son of God, it's the same temptation as in the Garden of Eden. Grasp for power. A false human-defined power. Grab for the shortcut. Grab for that which will make others follow your will. And Jesus says no to all of them. He will not take a shortcut. He will not do the magic tricks. He will take the long, difficult journey that leads to abandonment, rejection, and death on a cross, which Paul describes as the new tree. There is another tree. There's a garden in Gethsemane where Jesus is on hands and knees sweating as if it were blood to say, not my will, but yours. Jesus being poured out, not my will, but yours. And then another tree, a cross where he hangs, where the truest nature of God, the poured out, cruciform love of God that is entirely naked to human evil, is up there on the cross. Not just Jesus, but God is on the cross. God vulnerable, symbolically, and what we know of Roman crucifixion, literally naked, hanging on that tree. Here you have one who could have called down a legion of 10,000 angels to avoid getting arrested, but was vulnerable to human evil. The opportunity to grasp at that apple of human-defined power, he let go, poured himself out, became vulnerable to human evil. That's true divine power. That's the Imago Dei. That's why Jesus is the perfect lens through which we see God and the nature of God's power and the power we can partake in. God's power is made perfect, Paul says, in human weakness. God's power is true when we lay it down, when we give it away, when we are there for the least and the last and the lost. Matthew 25, judgment of the nations, separating the sheep from the goats. I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was in prison and you came and visited me. I was naked and you clothed me. When did we see you, Jesus? When you did it to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did it to me. When didn't we see you, Jesus? When you didn't do this for the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you didn't do it for me. Jesus brought the message of what God is like. A message of great vulnerability on God's part and great dignity on our part. That every person is beloved completely by God, and we are invited to respond by loving God back and loving each other, and that means offering each other our own power. Mutuality. Power with, shared, not power over. That dignity is ours because we are human. Jesus brought it to us as a fellow human, resisting every temptation to power to force it on us with divine or human authority. Jesus chose to walk the road we walk, all the way to a humiliating death on a cross. And the Bible says that is why God can love us and hold us, heal us, make us whole. Jesus is the very image, the very imago of God in the flesh, a perfect mirror of what it is to live as Imago Dei. I guess if there's a wrapped up conclusion, it's just this: we have a choice of what Adam to be like. The Adam who strove for power, human-defined, or the new Adam who showed us what it is in power to give up power, to lay it down, to make love the center and not authority. It sounds ridiculous to say, but be like Jesus. Live in love. Be fully human in the Imago Dei that is there for all of us.